Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust. It is April, and it's time for another episode of ASAP Nowcast. I'm your host, ASAP Now's Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust. And I'm just going to take a wild guess and say nothing much is happening where you are. Kind of low key time of the year. Nothing major. Obviously, that's sarcasm. We all know that we are facing probably the biggest challenge of our careers. Something that we've never seen before. SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19. And emergency physicians, we are in the spotlight. We are taking our moment to step up and do what is necessary. Just like we always do, except now I think the public really understands our role, and we're getting the appropriate recognition for what it is that we do. So really just gratitude and thanks for everything that you're all doing and for keeping us all safe. I know when I go to work, I have a lot of pride, and I'm sure you feel the same way. Let's talk about what's in this month of ASAP Now. A lot of COVID stuff, but also your bread and butter stuff as well. So let's not only do COVID, but we'll do a lot of COVID. First up, we have a piece written by Liam Yor, who is an emergency doc over in Washington State and works in the Puget Sound region, which is really, they got killed, right? This was where the nursing homes were having tons of cases of coronavirus really early, and you had this outbreak that was really devastating. And I asked Dr. Yor, who's a friend of mine just from the emergency medicine ASAP circuit, if you will, as a blogger and a very good tweeter, and I asked Liam, Dr. Yor, to write sort of a breakdown of what they'd learned early on. It was written back in March, which is ancient history, but it stands up because they were really there at the front line at the beginning of this, and it's worth going through because in some places you will nod your head and say, yeah, we've seen the same thing since then, and in places where you may not have seen as many cases, this might still be interesting and hopefully useful. So triage and treatment. What they found was that the clinical presentation of coronavirus was quite different than the typical cold or flu, and really that's marked by maybe a little labored breathing. I would add that sometimes there's a lot of tachypnea without labored breathing, but there's that labored breathing and very mild hypoxia. And in so many patients, I just really identify with this observation, the chest x-ray looks substantially worse than the patient felt. So you'd see this sort of classic viral patchy infiltrates all over the place. And of course, if you got a CAT scan, you'd see the ground glass opacities. You'd see these little just discrete areas, multi-lobar pneumonia, almost as if you had a very discrete infiltrate in like 5-6 places, which is a little unusual, right? I think usually we see a bunch of junk everywhere or one infiltrate, or it's sort of hard to say. This feels like when I look at these x-rays and these CAT scans, it almost looks like a little landmine went off in this part of the lobe, and then another landmine went off another part. And that's what Dr. Yoris was seeing. And basically, the next thing to think about is just triage in the sense of who can you predict is going to do worse. And what I think is so surprising is that patients will come into the department and they look okay. They have like slight hypoxia. And then boom, 6-8 hours later, they need to be intubated. So the usual sort of assessment of, oh, they're going to be fine. If I just give a little oxygen, they're going to do great. Nope, that's not really on board here. You have to really watch these folks like a hawk. And I'll just add that in the past couple of weeks, we've seen some scoring systems that you can see online, like MDCalc and other resources for free, that give you a sense of who might be at risk of needing intubation. And it's not so straightforward. So just take a look at that. And the next thing we want to think about is what our airway adjuncts are going to be. And as I think many of us know, bilevel positive airway pressure, BiPAP, is kind of frowned upon right now in many places because the worry is that this is a very aerosolizing procedure. In other words, the patient might be fine if they're on a circuit, but if they rip the mask off, they're going to be spewing viral particles everywhere. And healthcare workers like you and me and our nurses and our colleagues just across the board are going to be running into droplets where the virus can hang out for a little while. It's not airborne, but we know these droplets do go further than we might have anticipated early on. So that's something to be very careful on. I think people are returning to BiPAP and CPAP if they're a safe system for that in place and there's really adequate coverage, but be very careful with that. And not only that, it just seems to maybe not work that well is the observation, but I don't think we have data on that. The other thing is high flow nasal cannula oxygen. also being used a little more widely because it's a little less aerosolizing is the thought. But Dr. Yor felt that this wasn't helping a lot of patients. Really hard to say. And as I mentioned, the CT scan, is that really diagnostic versus an x-ray? I've seen the situation where I saw a patient who had this sort of mildly labored breathing, the tachypnea, a little hypoxia, but looking okay, speaking in full sentences and just looking like they were going to be all right. And I totally cleared chest x-ray. And I thought, you know, I don't buy it. So I did the thing where you sometimes get a CAT scan even though your x-ray was normal. And you don't want to do that all the time, obviously, for really obvious reasons that we all know is in terms of over-testing. But in this case, I think it makes some sense, especially when you don't have adequate coronavirus testing capability and you really don't know what you're dealing with. So can CT scans be diagnostic? And I think that there's limited data. There's some data from China on that. And we're going to see more coming forward as really the way to do this is to get a bunch of CAT scans and be blinded to whether or not the patient had coronavirus in terms of the PCR testing or maybe a bronchial alveolar lavage specimen testing that got the viral particles into a PCR and boom, you got a positive test. And so we don't really know what the sensitivity and specificity of a CAT scan is for diagnosing COVID-19, but it's certainly an area of interest. And if you don't have tests and you really aren't sure, if you don't have good tests otherwise, laboratory-based tests, then the CT scan is what some people are doing. Not optimal, but I think it's something that makes sense under the circumstances. From there, Dr. Yor had a nice little kind of section on how they set up their emergency department to prepare for the surge. I think that at this point, that's probably not going to help to go over here just because I'm sure that every hospital either already has this unfolded or unfolding, or if it hasn't hit them yet, they've got it going. But I did think that there was an interesting point that he made that we have some update on, which was, what are we going to do about Emtala? What are we going to do about patients coming in who really don't need to be in the department when we've got coronavirus? It's one thing to do tests and to admit patients to the hospital with our normal sort of risk-benefit calculation, but what are we going to do with our usual stuff in terms of capacity? And he asked a really interesting question, I think, about Emtala and how that was going to apply in this moment. And the good news is that CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, actually has given us some guidance on this in the interim time since this was written. And they're allowing the medical screening exam to occur via telehealth for the time being. This is really important because touching our patients is not that valuable. I think we all know that. And especially for the lung exam, the test characteristics of the stethoscope exam are pretty bad. If you look at the JAMA Rational Clinical Exam series, which is a couple decades old now. I think the first one ever was on pneumonia, actually. And just the stethoscope, whether it's ronchi or crackles, the inter-rater reliability is pretty terrible, and the diagnostic kind of negative likelihood ratios. You've got to be able to use a test to rule out coronavirus. You can't rely on your stethoscope. Not only that, the stethoscopes actually carry the virus, right? They're made of plastic, they're made of stainless steel. These are things that we know hold on to the virus. So we have to be very careful about spreading this disease. And so anytime we can avoid touching the patients, that's great. And CMS is now giving us the leeway to do that. And I would be remiss if I did not point out that we had a little bit of success here as a field in getting this done. I would first like to just say that Bill Jaquist, the president of ASEP, lobbied the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar on this exact topic, and that CMS had been flirting with the idea for quite a while. And so I think we actually made a difference here. I also wrote an op-ed that appeared in the Washington Post in which I made this argument. So I think that we've been out ahead of this issue, and it's nice to see progress happening. So kudos to ASEP for helping get that done, because we really need to do our jobs very well and very safely. One of the reasons I think this whole concept of minimalizing the touching and the stethoscope use and anything we can do to keep away from our patients, we now have some pretty good evidence and some emerging data about just how much of this virus has been spread through nosocomial means, right? Healthcare providers inadvertently spreading it within the hospitals. We see in the New England Journal of Medicine an article from a week or two ago where they described how one healthcare worker who was moonlighting at another place probably spread the virus, and even patients who had been transferred from one facility to the other were sort of the reason why an outbreak had occurred. And so we know this virus is very contagious, but we also know that healthcare settings and healthcare workers are a part of that. So we want to make sure that we're part of the solution and not a part of the problem. So check that article out. It's obviously both in print and online. Okay, next up, why don't we turn to something that's not coronavirus related? I know that seems like a crazy idea, but I just think it's useful for us to remember that even though we're not seeing a heck of a lot of anything else, we are still emergency doctors and we've got to be ready for anything. And I wanted to share an article written by Jonathan Strong, who's actually one of my colleagues here in Boston. We work together. And I asked him to look at something because I had a situation recently in which I needed to maybe do an assessment for a patient with a knee injury, and I wanted to know whether or not we had had the violation of the joint capsule of the knee. And I called orthopedics and I said, well, you know, don't we think maybe I'll do a saline load test to see if that joint has been violated? Can you help me out with that? I've got a lot of patients. Sometimes I'll do them myself. Other times I'll get the consults down. In this case, I'll admit I was going to have the consultant do it because we were kind of busy. And the consultant said to me, oh, Dr. Faust, we don't do saline load tests anymore because that's not evidence-based. And I said, well, that's interesting. I never heard of that. And usually I'm kind of up with the evidence in terms of not doing procedures that are unnecessary. Can you please send me a paper that would support this? What to me seemed like kind of breaking news, like, oh, wow, we don't have to do a saline load test anymore to see whether or not we have a traumatic injury to the joint capsule. And they said, yeah, okay, I'll send you the paper. And they sent me this paper, and it was pretty crummy, right? It didn't really help me because they said, look, we can do a CAT scan, and that's better than the saline load test. And it made us think, made Jonathan and I think, wait a minute. What does it take to overturn a medical practice that we do, like a saline load test, to see if there is any violation of the joint space in a traumatic injury, or traumatic arthrotomy is the technical term? What does it take to overturn an old practice? And the interesting thing you come up with is, it depends on how evidence-based the old practice was to begin with. And so it turned out that Jonathan looked into this, and since 1975 is when people have been doing the saline load test, and it's not even really that great of a test. I mean, we don't really know. It's sort of just what we do. And just a reminder, the way you do this is to use sterile technique, and you take a large needle, 18-gauge or larger, and you want to go to the area of the injury and basically violate an area away from the wound itself, but that was that you think might be connected, and essentially the same way you might do an arthrocentesis. So that's sort of, it can be ultrasound guided, and that's what you do. And what you're going to do is you're going to try to aspirate a small amount of synovial fluid, and then from there, you know you're in the right place, and you would want to inject some saline into the joint capsule. And then what you're trying to see is, does the saline actually come out the wound? And if so, you have probably identified that you violated the joint space with that injury on the other area. So one thing to keep in mind is that it's important to wait a few minutes after you do this to get some range of motion going, to see that sometimes there's some slow leakage. So you want to make sure that you don't miss anything. Big question always comes up, do we use methylene blue or not? And the answer seems to be that most people are not doing it so much anymore. Methylene blue is not currently recommended. And so then the question is, how well does the saline load test perform versus the CAT scan? And we've got a little bit of a dive on this from some data from the 1990s. And then in 2013, another approach was used. And in a couple of studies by this group, Conda et al., they assessed, again, this whole idea of the saline loading test versus a CAT scan. And the saline loading test does pretty well. It does in the 90s in terms of sensitivity and specificity. And then, of course, they're using the operative findings or the need to go to the operating room as their gold standards. And the problem is, in the case of the saline loading test, that just one patient missed really screws up their statistics. And that's probably real. But the problem here is that these studies are all in fairly low numbers. And so it's hard to really rely on that. But again, goes back to our whole problem, what is the gold standard to begin with, and what's that based on? And then finally, there is a study, which I think is kind of the crux of it, from the same group, looking at CAT scans, and they wanted to know if patients who didn't have any saline load testing, instead they had a CAT scan, how did they do? And in this study of 62 patients, it's too good to be true, 100% sensitive, 100% specific for diagnosing traumatic knee arthrotomy using direct arthroscopic visualization or septic arthritis at follow-up as the gold standard for diagnosis. And in that same study, the saline load testing was 92% sensitive only. So again, the problem is how many patients would have to be in each arm before you really had a good apples-to-apples comparison. We don't know. And that's why the conclusion of this is really that it all depends on your local patterns, what the orthopods like to do where you're at. You don't want to be deviating. At the same time, we do always want to ask, what is it based on? What's the old way versus the new way based on? Because if the old way is not that good, then we don't want to cling to it based on weak evidence. So that's a great piece. Check that out. Let's go to other parts of the magazine. Great piece here that I want to bring everyone's attention to by an emergency doctor who's joined our team, Dr. Janice Baker. And this is all about the difference between mentorship or mentees and protégés. And so if you are a teacher or you are the learner, the question is mentor, mentee, protégé, sponsor, a lot of different terms. And what I really like in this is that this idea of a differentiation between mentoring and sponsoring. And it really boils down to the kind of active role. And there's a lot of points here, so I want you to read the article. But the biggest one is that mentors are really a resource to go talk to, almost like a support. They support their mentees. Maybe there's formal or informal discussions. They talk about how to build these skills, or really very much the go for advice kind of resource, which can be very, very important. But a sponsor is a little more active, I think, is what I'm taking from this. The sponsor would really promote directly using his or her influence, networking to connect the mentee, maybe collaborating on a project. So a mentor might help the mentee craft a vision of a career or a project, and the sponsor actually gets involved and does it with them and actually might be, for example, the senior author on a first authorship paper of the mentee. So it's more active. So that's what I really thought was fascinating, was to think about the different relationships that you have either with the people who are the generation after you and you are guiding, or if you are still on the learning end, and even as you get longer and later into your career, there are still people that you can learn from, what it feels like to be either a mentee or someone who's kind of who's being sponsored by a person who is a resource. So great piece there. And let's move on to a couple other things before we wrap up. We've got an ongoing feature that we call benchmarking, which we give some really nice graphs and tables just to kind of give you a snapshot of what's going on in our world in the United States emergency medicine. This one is trends in United States emergency department imaging, and it comes from some CDC data. Pretty interesting, looking at between 2005 and then every year all the way through the beginning of the decade towards 2017, and over those years, what happened in terms of imaging rates in the department, how many patients got what and at any imaging at all. So any imaging at all, back in 2005, 43.7% of patients were getting some kind of imaging in the ED. Not surprising, a little under half. And over that period of time, it slowly crept up to 47, 48%. And last year, 49.7%, or the last year that we have data for, 2017, just about half, 49.7%, up about 6% from just a little over a decade ago. But interestingly enough, and this will make some sense, the rate of x-rays actually kind of stayed flat. So 35% of patients got x-rays, and pretty much up, a little down, a little up, a little down, and then it ends up right there at 35% today. So x-rays haven't changed, but not surprisingly, CAT scans and ultrasounds both definitely came up. So back in 2005, about 10% of patients, almost 11% of patients were getting CAT scans in the emergency department visit. Now that has jumped from 10.7% to 17.8%. So really almost one in six patients in the ED getting a CAT scan of some kind. And then ultrasound, still the least common kind of imaging that's obtained in the ED based on these numbers, but I think it's rising. And it started out back in 2005, only 2.6% of patients were getting ultrasound, and that's actually slowly and steadily risen to today, where it's 5.6%. So really over doubling in just the past 10 years. And I think that we're moving in that direction as well, especially as people are more comfortable with ultrasound, both in terms of its diagnostic utility and as more institutions recognize those findings as reliable as they are in many, many conditions. And then just jumping around the magazine, we've got our usual great stuff, EM Cases from Anton Hellman, looking at physician compassion in this case, a little different than as usual. We've got our coding wizard, always a little nugget there that even if you're not a coding person, kind of makes you go, I always like that. So this is about behavioral health and how we do that. And we already talked about the equity equation with mentor and sponsor. I thought that was great. Our face-ups in the crowd, these are the fellows of the college doing interesting things outside of medicine. And I love this. We've got a focus on pets, and we've got a couple of docs who have interesting hobbies related to cats and dogs. And the Medical Legal Mind column space is, again, just a fantastic resource that we've developed with Dr. Gita Pensa, alternating with Eric Funk. And this time around, we've got Dr. Pensa talking about expert testimony and how that can go the wrong direction. We've got the rainbow, over the rainbow feature, where we talk about making sure that your financial future is planned for. The resident voice talking about pandemic preparedness. We've got sound advice and our talks Q&A, always beautiful pictures as well. And we have some stuff on Until Help Arrives and great stuff, of course, from the college that the professionals and volunteer physicians as well are doing for all of us. So that's it. It's a great magazine. Check it out. It's online, of course. It's up now on Twitter and hitting your mailboxes soon. So thank you for listening, and we will see you next month here on ASAP Nowcast. ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.